The Israeli military is accusing him of being a Hamas sniper. For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnestad.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Pyrisa Neruzzi, and this is Taking Action on WPFW 89.3 FM. We come to you every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, bringing information and inspiration so that you can take action in our city to stop displacement, to save our schools and communities, to stand up for justice, build our power, and hold government officials accountable. Taking Action is produced by the grassroots organization Empower DC, and we welcome your feedback, your show ideas. You can reach out to Empower DC at 202-234-9119 or go to empowerdc.org. We look forward to hearing from you. So my guest today is somebody who I really enjoy talking to, so I'm excited to get the opportunity to sit with him today. Maurice Jackson is someone who has made great contributions to justice through his work as an activist, a scholar, and an author. Professor Jackson serves in the History and African American Studies departments at Georgetown University. And among his many contributions here locally, he was an inaugural chair of the DC Commission on African American Affairs, and through that presented analysis about African American employment and housing trends in Washington, D.C. He's received numerous accolades for his work and is a published author with several works, including his most recent work, Rhythms of Resistance and Resilience, How Black Washingtonians Used Music and Sports in the Fight for Equality. So Maurice, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Well, thank you, Professor. Thank you for having me, and thank you for all the work that you and your colleagues do to try to make D.C. a place that people like you and me can stay in.
I appreciate that a lot. You know, I always love to start with my guests, and today I want to, you know, talk about you and your work and your life and your perspectives on what's going on. I value those perspectives deeply. I wonder, though, to get the audience up to speed, if you could share a bit more about your personal background, maybe something about your family origin and early childhood experiences and how they've shaped your perspective and your work for justice.
Thank you. I'm just a cat from the projects of Newport News, Virginia, and grew up there and then spent some time. My folks split up and I spent some time with foster parents. Then I went to live with my grandmother in the Piney Woods of Alabama. So it's two experiences, the urban experience and the very rural experience. And came to Washington after I'd, left university. I suppose I was a good student, but I didn't like what they were teaching. So I came to Washington and then eventually started working for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And then I had been looking for marks all my life, and as a very young man, I joined the Communist Party and spent many years my youth there, 20, 25 years, and then became a top leader. But then I felt that when I joined, I felt that they were addressing the needs of African Americans. When I left, I felt they weren't. So so I always wanted to make a contribution, and I found very luckily that I could make a contribution in the academic world, which is a very difficult world. You know, you just don't jump into it. You have to take years and years of study and study and try to raise a family. But luckily I was able to do that and ended up at Georgetown University. So, have been fortunate because the administration of the school has appreciated the insight I bring to Washington, D.C., to the world, to the understanding of Black people, and to the struggles and strivings of just an ordinary working man and woman.
And you've been at Georgetown for some time now. What is it, over two decades, right? Are you?
Well, yeah. I came to Georgetown to study. I came here to study. Actually, I came here to study piracy. I came to study rebels of the 17th and 18th century, and I studied with a man named Marcus Rediker, and he was probably still is the foremost expert on sailors in the world. And I had been, you know, worked a couple of years in shipyard in Newport News, and then I worked on that and wrote the first book on actually Quaker abolitionism in the 17th and 18th century. And luckily, I went away for a while, but it's very difficult. And I had no intention of leaving D.C. at the time, so I was fortunate enough to get a job here and tenure and all those things and to publish and to write. So it's good. I been in the faculty here, I guess, for maybe 19 or 20 years, and still have some gas left in the tank, and I'm still finishing some projects that I think will make a contribution.
That's wonderful. You touched on this just briefly. First of all, you mentioned you had those early urban and rural experiences. You just mentioned that you had been a longshoreman. I wonder, at what point would you say, or could you describe some of your political awakening through those experiences? And how did you first, you talked about how you became a leader in the Communist Party, but what were some of your first entry points into organizing and social movement?
Well, that was a while later. You learn from the experiences of life. You learn from, as Ingalls once said, it's not the consciousness that determines the conditions of life, but the conditions that determine your consciousness. And especially those years I lived with my grandmother in Alabama. And I can remember that when I was at this little school and the school burned down and they would not build a school for Black kids. And we went to school in a cotton gin. If you've ever flown over Latin America or Haiti or somewhere, you see how buildings are made, the roofs are corrugated metal. And it was made of, and it was just an awful place. And so we didn't have books. And I have age on me, but I'm not that old. But we shouldn't have books. And so the teacher came with the mimeograph copies. And he had one copy he had from some fascist that he'd written. In the other hand, he had something that Marx had written. And I just asked for both of them. And I read those things. Maybe I was 10. And then somehow, I don't know how, I came upon an edition of Du Bois' Souls of Black Folks. And Booker T. Washington, Up from Slavery, Man Child in the Promised Land, Malcolm X's autobiography, and things like that. Somehow in the South, I was able to get them. I don't remember. And just kept them. And so when I went off to school, I had read those things, and I just wanted to deeper. I wanted to study the world. And of course, I dropped out and then went to work in the shipyard. But in the shipyard, you can in Newport News, you can make money, but you make twice as much as a longshoreman. And so all my neighbors were longshoremen, but they did not want to do weekend work because that's when the tobacco and all the heavy stuff comes in. This is before containerization. So I'd worked on the docks on the weekend and made enough. And interestingly enough, the guys on the dock, they called me Jackie, you got to get out of here. You can't spend your life here. You got to get out and go to school. And they were very, very supportive of me. And I understood it later. So luckily I was able to go back and finish undergraduate school. But at the same time, I was in Washington as an organizer. And in many of those years, I'd work construction, do construction jobs because you needed the money. Often I would work in the summers at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, I was just helping build stages and taking them down. It's tough work, but it helped me support my family, so I could deal with it.
Yeah, that's no joke because that's July, July in August, D.C. Yeah. I tell you, that's one of the hottest festivals you can go to. Although it's a beautiful
the dog days, festival. They called it. You know, in those days, it's very interesting. Though, when I first came to D.C. years ago, in August and July, nobody was here. Everybody left. But now it's just as packed because you have all the young people coming in, and you know, they have air conditioning in their houses. So they say the D.C. is not bad in August anymore like it used to be.
Yeah, if you can get indoors, that's for sure. I find it very unique, the mixture of subjects that you have already shared, that you've written about, that you've taught, and currently at Georgetown. My understanding is that you're both a professor in history and African American studies, as well as in performing arts or music. Could you explain sort of the cross section of the areas that you work in at the university?
Well, yeah, you know, when I did the first book, it was on Quaker abolitionism, on actually French Quaker abolitionism. And what was interesting about that was that I could really study ideas. And I studied the ideas of the great philosophers of the 17th, 18th century. This is Hutchinson and Wallace and Foster and Montesquieu and Adam Smith, and how they looked at the material world. I'd studied Marx and Engels all my life, but I wanted to study other theories, and I did that. And as I'm writing that, and I'm looking at ideas, I'm also trying to always write something that's purely academic and something that I enjoy at the same time. And I always enjoy writing about music. And in the process, I discovered the influence that the Haitian Revolution had on musicians. Charles Mingus, Haitian flight song, Duke Ellington, Black Bonnie Beige, and so many others. And so I then put together a volume on the influence of the Haitian Revolution on African Americans. And then luckily, I did another book on Quakers, but then I was at the Woodrow Wilson Center for a while. I started on a book that I just finished, and I was working on something, and I met a man who's a very dear friend today, Blair Rubel, who was actually a scholar of Russian studies, Soviet studies, and I spent many years in and out of the Soviet Union. And we decided that there were so many people in Washington with such vast knowledge of music, let's put together a volume. And we put together a magazine, and we brought in people like WPFW's Willa Jenkins, Billy Brower, who was one of the great minds of jazz, and other people. We put together John Hassey, who had been at the Smithsonian, and others. And then we realized that we wanted to put a book together, and to put the book together, we wanted to bring in more people. So we brought in the great Judith Curry, who's a curator of the Felix Grant Collection at UDC, and brought in a Lauren Sinclair, who at the time was getting her doctorate in NYU, and who's now is a dean at Loyola, but who did an article on Howard University of Music. And then Bridget Unwine, who did a piece on women in jazz. And so we expanded that and put together, because there was no single volume that really talked about the experience of jazz. And then from that, it did quite well. And from that, I was working on this very long book on Washington, D.C. I've just finished it. It's gone to the editors. But the book was so long, they said, man, you got to cut some of this. And it's very hard. So I said, let me look. And the section that would stand on its own were on music and sports. And I saw that, even though there's music and sports in this big book that comes out next year. And there's music and sports, which both things, whenever I work and I need some relaxation, I listen to music. But the main thing I do is read biographies of musicians for some reason. And I read biographies and of sports figures. I read pretty much any biography that comes out on some. You know, John Feinstein, the great writer of the Washington Post, just died. Well, I had read his book on Red Auerbach, and I had read books on Red Auerbach and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I'm sorry, John Wooden and Kareem, and just many things come out. And so in doing that, I saw truly how music and sports had such a great impact on people in this nation's capital. But most importantly, I saw that the only two things that in my lifetime have really brought people together in Washington, there were three or four things. One was when the football team won, and the three times they won a championship, and people just come out in the street. I mean, you know, thousands of D.C. multicultural, multiracial. When the hockey team won a couple of years ago, there were hardly any black people came out. When the baseball team won, not that many. Who can afford the ticket? But when that football team won three times, once with a black quarterback, and we lived in Adams Morgan at the time, you know, my wife and I were I guess, courting at the time, and we would go out on the street and just masses of people. Then when the Georgetown Hoyas won, and it brought people together, and under Big John Thompson, someone says he may not own the city, but he almost does because of what he's a native son of Washington. And the only two times that I've ever, in the years I've been here, seen people come together that much outside of those things, the anti-apartheid struggle when people of all races and colors went together at the embassy there, and the movement for rent control. Because the movement for rent control, it united the little widow men and widow women up in Kennedy Warren, up Connecticut Avenue, people all the way up in Chevy Chase, D.C., they lived, to people in Anacostia. People joined together, and there was a guy named, I remember Joe Davis was the old Black Panther leader, and how he helped him organize for that. And Mark Looney and so many other people became a part of that. And these are the things that sort of inspired me. I should say about music, though, that I didn't realize until I was researching this book. We all know the example of Marian Anderson. But what I had forgotten or didn't know, that when Marian Anderson sang at the mall in 1939, this was one of the largest demonstrations of blacks and whites in America at the time. But that was the beginning of the 20-year struggle to desegregate Washington, D.C., because what happened is when she sang that, they desegregated the federal lands, but they did not desegregate local lands. So when she wanted to sing in Constitution Hall, she had no, because that was a private entity. When she wanted to sing at Central High School, which is now Cardozo High School, she was denied because of segregation. But the federal lands, they integrated those thanks to the good work of perhaps one of the greatest first ladies, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, who resigned her membership in the Daughters of the American Revolution.
Yeah, I mean, you've woven together so many just gems of people and moments in history, and I was really struck by you saying that these are of all of the years that you've been in D.C. and with your background as an organizer, that the moments that you have really seen people come together, you know, sports has been one of the key things, and in this moment in time, of course. You know, there's an effort, the mayor has an effort to bring a new football stadium to D.C., bring the Commanders back to D.C. And there are some folks, some Native Washingtonians that I know who say, you know, this is important to us because it's a sense of, hometown pride, and it has a significance that's beyond, you know, just a football game. On the other hand, we're in a city that has built a lot of things like stadiums with a lot of taxpayer money while neglecting the needs of the lowest income, and, you know, has become a city that's very, very difficult to afford to reside. I saw an article the other day that was saying now they're saying that the income needed to maintain a quality of life in D.C. is $189,000 a year, which, you know, the median income. I just saw that the other day, and the median income for Black families in D.C. is under $50,000 a year, I believe, right. Still. So I just wonder, how do we reconcile these two things that, you know, on one hand, sports can be a unifier. On the other hand, you know, the people benefiting financially not to be the people, you know.
Well, sports as we like it and the hard reins of capitalism are two different things. I will say this. Sometimes we can get right silly. I saw that a Councilman McDuffie introduced a resolution that said that to make D.C. the sports capital of the nation. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth. D.C. is not the sports capital of America. You'd have to go to New York or Boston or Philadelphia or L.A.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever what we're going to be known for here, I'll tell you.
No. So why waste your time? Yeah. See, here's the thing about sports, and I'll come back to the stadium. On any given Sunday, you can go to the grocery store, go to the Giant or whatever grocery store, and I come to work on Mondays, and I see something that's really fascinating. And you will see the guys and the ladies, Black and white, they're dressed up in their football regalia. Even though the old football team with the awful name is gone, people still have the colors. And so it'd be the Washington team in Dallas. And people really don't know why. And it's because For many years, the Washington team refused to integrate, would not allow people until Bobby Mitchell and Charlie Taylor came. Would not allow. The theme of the songs was "Hail, Old Redskins, Hail, Old D.C. Hail to the Redskins, Hail, Old Dixie." And this was the there was no football beyond the Mason-Dixon line. So what happened is that the Dallas Cowboys were in the old American Football League. And the Washington teams, and so people like me grew up in Newport. We were all Baltimore Colts fans. Lenny Moore, and Gino Marchetti, and all Raymond Burr, and Johnny Unitas, and all that. So what happened was that, so this battle still go on today, especially people from North Carolina. They're all hardcore Dallas fans, which we understand. But they had Bob Hayes and people like that. But it's in good spirits. And then in sports, you also had. You know, the modern sports owner, you remember Mr. A. Poland, who was, by all intents and purposes, a great owner. He owned when he bought the Baltimore Bullets, he changed the name to the Willards. He had a moratorium on that. Mr. Poland could have bought all of downtown. He had the money, he could have bought it. He said, no, I don't want to do it. I want the city to work with developers and have community housing and things like that. That was his vision. A lot of it came from his mother, who had grown up in old Russia around certain social Democrats. But he had grown up poor, I think, in Philadelphia. But we don't see that with the owners now. It's just pure copy. The owner now, Leonsis, tried to bribe the city and go out there in Virginia. They didn't want him, and now he's back. You know, and so you have the notion of the stadium. It's one simple act. Put it to a referendum. Put it to a vote. Let the people decide. Let the sides battle it out. You never get the money that you put into it. It does not provide a long-term jobs. Even the people who build the stadium, if you look at construction in this city, if you look and you look at the cranes, look up. As my grandmother would say, you don't see Negro one. I didn't say that. She said, and what she meant was that you don't, when you see these big cranes, these guys making $200 an hour, you don't see black people on that. You don't see black, and a lot of these are jobs. So the unions have not opened them up to, and have not had apprenticeship programs that train young black and Latino and Asian kids to be plumbers, electricians, mm-hmm. all. So this is highly skilled labor that's going to build that. And most of the labor is going to probably come from outside. My university, to the credit of the president emeritus, Jack DeJoya, says that any project mm-hmm. that you have on this campus has to have half of the people must be from the city of Washington. And what he meant in that sense was the workers and things like that. But there's no guarantee when you have these things. Marion Barry, whenever anything, and whether it was lawful or not, whenever you had anything in this city, he demanded that these workers, that these companies hire black workers. And he had a head of minority business named Cortland Cox, who had come out of the non-action group in New York, but also this student nonviolent coordinating committee. So they had this sense of dedication too. But unless someone has that, so let the debate begin. And the mayor, but mm-hmm. it has to be put to a public referendum about that. And then and let the residents decide, those who will be paying. You know, the stadium out in the baseball stadium and the soccer stadium, I don't know if they created any jobs. I just don't know. I haven't seen mm-hmm. where they have created permanent jobs. They
yeah.
do displace
mostly seasonal. Yeah, I think. Yeah. Well, I'm curious, you know, again, as somebody who has been involved, I mean, as a leader of the Communist Party in particular, which has a frame of reference in terms of working people and, you know, of course, was outside of mainstream politics and outside of the two-party system and all of that. And then you've been, you know, in academia, you've done all of the scholarly work, and you've been in D.C. now for decades. What is what's your take on the city today? Because, I mean, even the reports that you did and in the launch of the Commission on African Americans, what is that, about a decade ago, a little more mm-hmm. than a decade ago, the city has continued to go down this trajectory of becoming, mm-hmm. you know, a haven for wealthier people, right. for, you know, predominantly whiter people, mm-hmm. lower income, black people in particular have continued to be displaced and not, like you said, not benefit from right. the job, the opportunities, et cetera. So, you know, I don't know, what's your reflection on that? Is that yeah. due to a lack of organizing and political power? Is it due to other forces that shape yeah. the city? I mean, what do you think?
Well, when I left the Communist Party, you know, a couple of decades ago and went to academia, I did it because I did not feel that the issues of the day, the issues affecting the average of black man and woman, and were being addressed. It was too much rhetoric, too much self-centeredness, too much elitism. And I wanted to really get to certain problems. I don't condemn anyone who stayed or left. That was. But I also found that it was not a deep-centered study of problems of urban American, black American. I've often said, even when I was traveling all over the world, I saw that sometimes people who were in the international movement somehow thought they were somehow better, doing more noble work than the guy who was just at the grassroots level. And I was always, even though I traveled all the world, I was always, a man who kept. And in fact, that's why I kept jazz, because a lot of people on the left don't pay much attention to, maybe Bruce Springsteen or things like that. I don't knock it. I dig some Bruce Springsteen, some other things like that, but I have to have my jazz. And a lot of people there didn't see the importance of the jazz. So I sort of drifted, but that didn't mean that I didn't try to understand the problems. And what happened was that it was about 6 years ago that the mayor, I had given a talk at Georgetown University, and the mayor was here. This at the time was Mayor Gray, and I didn't know the mayor. And I gave a talk about D.C. Emancipation Week, and it was, I guess it went when the president of the university was there, and the mayor knew the president because they were both practicing Catholics, and he said, I want you to introduce me to that cat. I'd known people. I knew John Wilson. I knew Barry and all that, but I didn't really know the mayor. And so they called me up and asked me, would I lead this new commission that Marion Barry had established? And I said, well, I'll tell you the two things, Jackson, me and me. I don't go to many meetings. I'm just not wasting my time. And I don't go to meetings where people have already made the decisions. And that's what happens at a university. That's what happens in the city. So I will invite you. They'll invite you to talk about a stadium. They'll invite you to talk about an issue, but they've made their mind up. So you don't make me feel good. So they said, well, you lead the commission. Well, so the president wanted me to do it. I did it. But what I didn't know, Parisa, was that the city would not give me one bit of help. All these researchers they have, you call them and they didn't have information. They didn't have. So what am I going to do? So I was able to get some crackerjack student researchers at the Georgetown School of Public Policy. I had worked at UPO. Not a panic organization. And who did I work for? I worked under a guy named Jerry Obama Washington. And we would work and we would do our work in the community. And then he would take me to Bill Harris's Pigfoot and all these places like that. Well, in the process, I learned how to do statistical analysis. I taught myself. So I knew how to do it. I just couldn't make the charts. And so these students helped. And then we saw the deep inter. And you mentioned some, but we saw that the average wealth of a white family is 83 times more than a black family. You mentioned 40,000. Well, it's even worse than that, because what happens is that they throw in median income. The mayor creates certain houses. She says, I want to have 5% set aside for people of the median income. Well, the median income of blacks and the median income of whites is very different. The average income of white people in D.C. is about 140, 150 grand. The average, the median income of blacks is about mid to 40 something. And so if you put it together, it comes out to about 100 grand, maybe a little bit more than that. So the average black family does not have that kind of money. And so you may give them, it may be 50% of the median, but that's still $50,000. So you might have set asides, but not many people can get those set asides. So you have that. And so increasingly, and the housing stock goes down. And you know, you've been around long enough, Parisa, to know that, 10 or 15 years ago, you'd have a family. You'd have a family. Maybe they had three or four kids. And somebody always stayed in that house. Somebody always stayed there. And Adams, Mark, wherever, you know, somebody worked hard. But now it doesn't happen, because if you got three or four kids and they have no money, somebody said, nope, you got to divide this money up. So the houses go. People forget the taxes. All these things, the corrupt schemers come in, buy up taxes. When a people or a poor person forgets one payment, and the city doesn't help them get into the rear. So you have and you just lose the housing stock, and that's afraid what's going down. So it's driving and the numbers of African Americans in the city now it's a little over 42%. In 1957, the city became the first urban city with majority black population. 57, this is the same year that Eisenhower passed the desegregation order in the city. In 1970, 70%, and D.C. became known as the last colony. Robert Hooks, the great actor, had a theater company up on George Avenue. He took the old Colony Theater, which has been a white theater, and he named some Last Colony Theater, because he had been at the theater up in Harlem. And it became, then over the years, of course, it became known as Capital City, Capital, you know, Chocolate City. They used to have a sign at the corner of D.C. And Maryland up, you know, up near North Portland States up that way. But it's changed so much now. And I'm afraid that that I don't know how in the world we get this population black. We have to just halt the. The thing about Washington is that, you know, if you live in New York City, the average person is not going to live in a house, not anymore. The average person in Washington, I have a house. We've been there a long time. And it's probably easy for me to say, but most people are going to have to live in apartment buildings. When I did this study, I said, why don't we start turning these buildings downtown that are vacant into, and the mayors and their people say, oh, it can't be done. It's too hard. What do you mean it's too hard? If you can build the buildings, you can change them around. That's not the hard, we just change pipes. Now, would it take effort? Of course. But don't tell me it's harder to change pipes than it is to put that skyscraper up. It makes no sense. Now they're talking about really doing it, but they have to make it affordable for people. You know,
well, that's the challenge, right? Because, yeah, they're not. I mean, I think making it affordable at this stage requires subsidizing it. And exactly. Unfortunately, the leaning of the administration is we want to continue to attract higher income people. And it's OK if lower income people are displaced. I mean, I think that we see that through every action, through every policy, through the budget, through the demonization of tenants. And the mayor has made a lot of statements about tenants cheating the system and, you know, all of this without any empirical proof whatsoever. I mean, making these statements, then cutting the resources available to prevent eviction, et cetera. And I'm, you know, then here we are in this moment, right, with this guy in office where, you know, there's an attempt to prevent the city from being able to, you know, fully use its own budget from already 6 months into the current year budget. And then, you know, of course, all of the other attacks on DEI and all of the other attacks in general and all of the social welfare programs. So I wonder, with your deep knowledge of history, how do you interpret today's political moment? Is this inevitable? Did we see it coming? Is this, you know, the continuation of white supremacy? Did we mess up somewhere?
Certainly not inevitable. You know, it had the forces of progress, you know, really come together and united as they could have. And this includes African Americans, it includes Arabs, it includes Hispanics, included. This could have been stopped. But it's there now. You know, Leon Trotsky had, you know, the theorist had a theory, and it was a silly theory, but the worse the better. And somehow some people believe that, but that is not true. The worse the things are, it's not the better, meaning better for organizing. It's just not true. And if you look at what's happening now, you look at the rhetoric, you look at a sense of meanness and mean-spiritedness that I don't know if I've seen even in my life. When a man named Elon Musk can compare federal workers to Hitler and say that federal workers have done more to harm the nation than Hitler, well, what nonsense. Because what he's doing is attacking black workers, because the public sector jobs as teachers, as firemen, as garbage workers, as cafeteria workers, this has been the bulwark of the black economic. Blacks are far more represented in the public worker force, and they're not late. These are people doing essential jobs. You know, in this study, I've just finished the big book on Washington. What I looked at was that there have been so many efforts to better life. The garbage worker struck in 1970s, the metro worker struck, the teachers, all to make it better for themselves and their family. But they use this rhetoric. But then it goes beyond that to Elon Musk's treatment. It goes to when, this is how we have to think deeply. When this man and his people cut back sending vaccines to people in Africa, they will do the same thing here. And you're talking about 200,000 people going to die next year because they can't get the polio vaccine. You're talking about several million who would die because of they can't get the tuberculosis shot. I just read Anthony Fauci's, he teaches here at Georgetown. I just read his book, his biography. And some strengths and some weaknesses. For example, when he talks about the AIDS crisis, he doesn't say much about magic or Arthur Ashe, a little bit, but how they contracted AIDS and things. But he goes into it very well. And I just read the other day that they're going to cut back the HIV funding. Now, as we know, HIV has been halted, but it's not been eliminated. You can have suppressants, but that doesn't keep you from getting other disease. And so the education thing, so they're cutting back all this and training, and then cutting back at the labor department, apprenticeship programs, and all these things that help people. So it's really, now here's the thing, Parisa, and I believe that that when you talk about cutting back all these programs, you talk about cutting back food aid to Africa, then you were talking about cutting back on the people who are sending foods to Africa. Now, that is a lot of farmers in the Midwest. These farmers have Caterpillar combine trailers that cost $1 million. They can't pay for them. You have food rotting. They'd rather have food rotting than send it to Somalia, Sudan. And the same thing happens here. The food deserts are just increased. The problems are different, but similar. So when and then the thing about the budget, I did not know the other day that I saw a new figure that D.C. pays more tax than 10 states. Now, I have to dig up the numbers because I just saw it somewhere. And as a historian, I have to make sure it's true. But if that's the case, then we have even more right to determine, our destiny. So, but they just see people. I mean, you know, I'm sure mm-hmm. Mr. Trump and O.C., you know the term he used for Africa, a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they use the same term for, you know, for African Americans.
Mm. And for the industry. So I wonder then, from your organizing perspective, this crisis, in crisis, there's opportunity, right? You just mentioned, you're talking about how such a wide swath of people are being harmed by these policies. Perhaps there's an opportunity to use that impact to create some unity. However, we're in this two-party system and we're feeling, that the Democratic Party is too bought and sold by certain, corporate interests and really hasn't been able to show any leadership. And I wonder from your perspective as somebody who was part of a third party, is there any hope, for a third party, or do we just have to do what we do, create our own kind of Tea Party within the Democrats? And to the left. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Jill Stein doesn't get many votes. Cornel West doesn't get many votes. Let me say this. Mm-hmm. All this is going to be left up to people like you and the work you do in the Housing Act and other people in D.C. I think the idea of the great man, the great party coming, I don't necessarily see it. Americans, we are so individualistic. We unite around issues. And I think probably now we need to unite around the issues more than theory. No single theory is going to bring us together. Of course, I have theoretical. I spent years studying theory, but I don't see people are doing. Let me give an example. The Black Lives Matter movement. What a great movement it could have been. And it's sort of scattered now. There was nothing that kept people together. There's nothing. It wouldn't be a party that kept. It had to be a single set of ideas and a single set of principles. You have to have a program. And so people come together in the convention. It doesn't have to be a party. It could be in it. Come together in the Negro National Convention, many others come together and with a strong set of ideas. So instead of, maybe there should be I wouldn't say a housing party movement, but I know you all have had conventions. They have conventions with a set of ideas around housing and a set of demands that put that people are united upon. I've read that that AOC and Mr. Sanders are, on the road, are touring, rallies and things are good, but you have to leave something back. That was the beauty of the Rainbow Coalition, you see, when even with the problems, and it wasn't just Reverend Jackson, because he had a core of people, that when he left town, there was somebody who had something in place to build something. And it didn't, unfortunately, it did not last forever, but that was a period of hope. Now, we need something like that. One of my colleagues wrote something recently and said we have to get rid of the idea of a multiracial coalition that doesn't. And I'm thinking, what in the world are you talking about? That's the only way you're going to win anything is by multiracial.
That's our only hope, I think.
It is the only hope. You know, black folks didn't. You know, I hate to say it, but black folks didn't put us in this mess. And
that's right.
The numbers about all these. Well, maybe some black men did. So I asked a buddy man. I said, is it true that that these black guys are going to vote for the, he said, man, the black guys, they talking about not voting in the first place. They just guys aren't voting there. And so maybe, you know, some few with their hands out or things like that. But don't put this on us. Now, if we stayed home, then we create as much a problem as others. So we have to just get back, you know, to the local is the national. Well, now in writing this book that I've just finished, the big one, but yeah. I realized that if you understood things locally, you could pretty much figure them out, in a sense, nationally and globally. If you put, because it's the same, you know, many of the same sources. You know, Elon Musk, with all the tax write-off and getting billions of dollars to do what he's doing and giving it by the government. At the same time, they talk about cutting, but look, they put in the largest. It is capitalism at its best. And see, here's the thing about capitalism. It is no longer for us to talk about overthrow. Look, it is so strong, but you can do things. Let me give an example. During the COVID crisis, if you remember, I was overseas teaching a part of the time, but what I saw was a nation that could do something if it wanted to. And what happened was that poverty was pretty much eliminated because everybody got aid. Maybe your rent, you got help with your rent. If you needed help, you got help. The hospital and things like that. A lot of people who didn't need help got it, but a lot of people did and was able to, except some corrupt people, business people, corrupt and corrupt them. But we saw the strength of what this system can do if we put it to the test. Now, if we democratize it, if we socialize it in such a way, but now people are being, demonized more or less. We saw what in fact could happen. We saw even with Biden, we don't hear Biden's name anymore. But the fact is that I don't know of any president who was more pro-labor than this man, who did more for labor. But we spend time fussing about it instead of now. I see that AFL-CIO has come back together. That the unions that had left the AFL have come back together. So there's there's hope in that. I hope that the same type of unity can extend itself to the movement against, the war machine, in the Middle East and things like that. But it takes that. So whether that's a third party, I don't know. It takes, it would take some of your radio programmers there to figure out what I can't.
Well, I know we don't have you too much longer, so I do want to make sure we talk a bit more about Rhythms of Resistance and Resilience, your latest work. How Black Washingtonians use music and sports in the fight for equality. What are some of the highlights of this this work and some of the elements that you learned from that one?
Well, I'm going to be, I've been speaking on this book pretty much all over the place. I'm at the Wharf at Politics and Pills tomorrow night. I'll be at the D.C. Historical Conference next weekend, and I'll be at UDC on the first, all events, free and nonpartisan. The main thing about this book is that I keep finding things new. Shakespeare said, he who has no music has no soul, he or she. And I saw that music and culture is really the soul. And it goes back. Let me give you just one example. The great Frederick Douglass came to Washington, and he had a great love of music, and he became an amateur violin. His violin is at his house in Cedar Hill in Anacostia. He had a grandson named Joseph, who became one of the first classical violinists, black classical violinists, studied at Oberlin, then overseas, and then became the first tenured black professor of music in the country. Now, this is Joseph, his grandson. His father was named Charles, Joseph's father, Frederick Douglass' oldest son, who went off and joined the 54th and became a hero in the Civil War, came to Washington, worked in the Reconstruction Bureau. And at his hobby, he founded a baseball team which played ball at the White Lot, which is right down where by the mall, near Lafayette Square, down that way. And there you had baseball played, and you had a cricket that had come, you know, if all those who know the great Coach Onamide, they know he talks about cricket all over. But C.L.R. James wrote a book about cricket, but they about cricket and lacrosse and things like that. And they played, and the blacks and white team played separately, but they took turns. But then racism, again, it always rises head. And when it rose its head again, the white teams did not want the black team to share. And the white lot was right up the street from Foggy Bottom, not far from Georgetown. And so blacks had to go and find their own places. And then, of course, when the teams are formed, you know, the baseball teams, the white teams came in, they stormed road, and many times they would beat the African-American teams because they would bring players from all over the country. But it was all right. They played good. And do you know that in 1794, when Absalom Jones and Richard Allen are members of the church in Philadelphia, the same thing happened. The whites tapped on their shoulder and said, you cannot worship in this church anymore. And they went off and found their own church, the AME Church and the African Episcopal, African Methodist Episcopal and the Episcopal Church. The same thing African-Americans did with the baseball team. Now, baseball, as we know, the senators refused to integrate. And so the blacks created something called a Homestead Grays. They played half their games in Griffith Stadium, half their games in Pittsburgh. Do you know that these games had more people attending than did the Senators? And of course, the Washington Senators moved out of Washington to keep from integrating. And then they went to Minnesota, and then they were sold to George Bush in Texas. Now they have, you know, a new team. And so I was able to look, but and then sports. It was a man named Edwin Henderson, E.P. Henderson, and Henderson became the founder of sports. But you know, this man, E.P. Henderson, was the first man who helped to create a recreation department within a public school. This is what black people do. What people don't realize is that after Reconstruction, when Reconstruction and the Bureau of Immigrants, Refugees, and Slaves, when this happened, this created a whole system of public schools, a whole system of public hospitals that we had never known. It created and the Ohio State University, the Michigan State University, Oklahoma, all these schools became schools that were supported by the federal government, just like the HBCUs were. So this is the beauty, because what whites have not realized in this country is that whatever has been done to help the black person, whatever, has helped them more. You could tell me Medicaid. You can tell me you can tell me anything you want. Medicine. So you know it's and so as I looked in Washington, I looked at what these African Americans were doing, what Marian Anderson were doing, what the great forewarns, what John Thompson did as a sportscaster to bring this city together, and the lessons that they teach. There are so many. And last, I would say that we have two children. We always insisted that they play sports and music. My wife says, well, I wanted to play sports because I was such a failure at it. Well, what happened was I grew up in the South, and in the South where I lived, there, where my grandmother lived, if you played sports, you had to walk home at night, and it's dark. And she wasn't going to let you walk home at night and get run over by some car. It was just, I thought I was going to be, you know, a great flanker like Paul Warfield or somebody, but flanker, to those who know, is a football wideout. So anyway, but I saw what sports did to help them enhance themselves, to give them confidence when they were going through these very difficult schools, and how it helped make them and each one now, especially their son goes out and plays soccer almost every basketball, and they have they're not playing instrument, but they have a love of music, a love of jazz. They listen to it. They have a big jazz collection. Are they gonna take my collection when it's no? Probably not. They say it's too many, but they listen to the music. And they about a sports fan. They see the importance of it.
It sounds like it's really an element of nurturing the spirit that underlies our ability to pursue justice and finding that recreation and that respite in music and in sports that gives us the energy that the spirit to be able to keep pushing on and keep fighting.
It is, and now it costs so much to go to games and things like that. That's why we can support high school teams. We can support
teams.
We can support women's teams and things like this. So
that's right. And Professor Jackson, I always enjoy speaking with you. I'd love to have an opportunity to continue this conversation. I know you've got your additional publication coming out, I think later this year or next year. You described it sort of like a people's history of D.C. Is that right? Am I accurate?
It's called Halfway to Freedom, the struggles and strivings of African Americans in Washington, D.C. Strivings from the from Driver's Row, which was off DuPont Circle where other blacks lived. Struggles. Mm-hmm. Halfway to Freedom, you know. When I came to D.C., I didn't want to stay. Why would I want to stay in D.C.? I wanted to get to New York. Mm-hmm. That's where the music was. But I ended up here. I got, you know, and family got married. And then I found a little enclave where I could live. But I still wanted to get to New York. My idea of a vacation. You know, my wife likes the beach. My wife vacations a week in New York City to hear, to go and hear that jazz. And I found a way to do it, to go. But D.C. is a city of the great musicians, a lot of them, Shirley Horn, Buck Hill, many of those decided to stay home. But D.C. has produced some outstanding musicians. And, of course, centering in on this, the three greatest basketball players to come out of D.C. is, of course, the greatest Elgin Baylor, and then, of course, Dave Bing, and then Mr. John Thompson was a great high school and college basketball player. And the pros, well, he couldn't be because he played behind Bill Russell, who never sat down. And so, you know, the great individuals that sit in. And, of course, the great Duke Ellington comes out of D.C. The great Billy Taylor comes out of D.C. You know, Billy Hart, the great drummer, comes out. So many bass players. A young drummer, Cush Abaday, whose father is a dear friend, NASA Abaday, play in there. You know, Ben Williams, Corcoran Holt, Michael Boyd, some great bass players. Come out of the spirit of Butch Warren. I mean, it's the city's just, you know, clock full of great musical endeavors. And sports people who are still playing. Caleb Williams, the guy who just number one in the country, then went to Chicago Bears, comes out of Washington, D.C. and played the Mathers. So, you know, we're still doing it. And the sisters and the women who, you know, who are playing, many coming out of St. John's High School and many others. Miss Bud up at Connecticut is playing, come out of D.C. So many others, so many great ones.
I look forward to reading it, and I hope that on your itinerary is to write your own autobiography. Is that a work in progress too?
My daughter wants me to, but who wants to talk? I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about myself. It's a lot of you know, when you grew up, with hardworking women like my grandmother and mother, where you don't spend a lot of time thinking and talking about yourself. So I don't really. But maybe I will, because I'm reading a lot of biographies now. I'm reading biographies 20, 30, 40, 50, whatever. And I think one line, it's a very good Bible. You know what I read? The one line I see, including Mr. Obama, is that none of them ever worked a hard day in their life. They never worked with their hands. It's just surprising.
Right.
Man, they can write. They're beautiful writers. But none ever touched the factory. Never swept it. You know, it's amazing. But lucky them, I guess. Lucky them.
Professor Jackson, thank you so much again for all of your contributions. I mean, I envy the students who get to study under you. I hope they understand what a privilege they have there. Thank you for these works that you've published and your continued leadership. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the role that you've played with the Working Group on Slavery, Memory, and Reconciliation at the university, and helping the university really confront its own past and put some reparative in place. So we'll have to have you back to talk about those things.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. And I know you got to get to class across the campus. So thanks again for joining, and we'll talk to you again soon. And to our listeners, thanks. And to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to Taking Action. Stay tuned for Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. But first, the news.
Oh, African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora is featured at the 21st New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 14 to the 27th. The festival features 29 films from 19 countries, discussions with filmmakers, and more. The 2025 New African Film Festival features the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa. Tickets and full schedule at AFI.com/silver. That's AFI.com/silver or at 301-495-6700. That's 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Last week, President Trump signed an executive order drastically cutting the Department of Education's workforce. For that reason, a lawsuit has been filed this week against his administration by a group of parents and organizations, including the NAACP and the American Federation of Teachers, which is the second largest teachers' labor union in America. The suit argues that federal departments can only be created and dissolved by acts of Congress rather than a president's decree. The unions also say that Trump's move could affect vulnerable students, including those with individual learning plans and students who live in impoverished areas, students who have historically relied upon more federal dollars for education funding. The White House announced today that Russian and Ukraine officials have agreed to a ceasefire in the Black Sea, and this comes after American officials met with representatives of each country separately in the capital of Saudi Arabia to discuss an end to the 3-year-long war. Both countries have also agreed to no longer strike each other's energy facilities. Echoing a statement from the White House, Ukraine's defense minister confirmed that, quote, all parties have agreed to ensure safe navigation, eliminate the use of force, and prevent the use of commercial vessels for military purposes in the Black Sea. Today is Diabetes Alert Day, which falls on the fourth Tuesday of every March. Diabetes is a condition where a person's body cannot regulate sugar properly. Over time, it can lead to serious health complications, including heart, kidney problems, and nerve damage. According to the National Institutes of Health, 38.4 million Americans, or about 11.6% of the U.S. population, have diabetes, and 8.7 million are unaware that they have the condition. Dr. Kwame Okoto, an intern, those first triggers of sugar intolerance, and then the process worsens from there. However, Dr. Okoto notes that a pre-diabetes diagnosis does not automatically mean that a person will get diabetes. He said lifestyle changes can help, including a healthier diet with more fruits and vegetables, as well as 150 minutes a week of exercise activities such as walking, using a treadmill, bike riding, or resistance training. He added that regulating body weight can reduce your risk of diabetes by 58%. To the D.C. area, weeks after 3 measles cases were confirmed in Howard and Prince George's counties, Maryland, the D.C. Department of Health confirmed today a positive case of measles in a person who visited various locations in the district while contagious. The measles is a highly contagious disease that spreads through the air when an infected individual breathes, coughs, or sneezes. Symptoms, which often appear in 2 stages, range from high fevers, runny nose, watery eyes, to tiny white spots that appear in one's mouth. These symptoms typically don't begin to show until after the 7th day that the virus was contracted. Potential exposure sites for this D.C. case of the measles include 2 Amtrak locations in Northeast D.C. and the MedStar Urgent Care Facility in Adams Morgan, Northwest D.C. on March 19th and March 22nd, respectively. Officials say that anyone who is not immune to measles who traveled to the potential exposure sites during those noted dates are urged to contact their health care provider or call DC Health for guidance. That number is 844-493-2652. Again, 844-493-2652. In today's weather, it's currently about 62 degrees in DC. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe, and thank you for listening.